people can belong to whatever category they want.
It's right that we kill them because it's our place to kill them.
You can't make policies that affect all people based on an individual's lived experience.
That is naive realism, believing that you see reality the way that it is.
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
All right, David, what are we talking about today?
Today, we have a topic submitted by a viewer.
A viewer submitted topic.
Even, because this is not a video show.
You can view the sound wave.
That is not how sound waves work.
I mean, yeah, but still. How useful would it be if your eyes could not only detect... Like, imagine the surface of your eyeball being able to actually sense the vibration in the same way your eardrums do.
That is pretty much how echolocation works, pretty sure.
Huh.
That's how I imagine it working. Whenever I imagine what it would be like to be a bat.
My eyes feel the vibration.
Well, not eyes specifically, but, like, yeah, seeing things like that. And then, like, the different textures of things coming back as colors, things like that. That's how I imagine that.
Interesting.
Yes. Anyway, this episode is not about bats at all.
Or that at all.
Or even your senses. We talked about that last week, kind of. This week, we are going to talk about postmodernism.
Oh, the postmodernist agenda.
Yes.
Our favorite friend.
This episode is sponsored by Kermit the Frog.
Kermit B. Frog. Wait a minute. That's a different person. It doesn't matter. So, what is a postmodernism?
Well, I think to talk about postmodernism, we should first talk about modernism.
That's a good point. I actually, no one says modernism.
That's because modernism is old now, which is a fun thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, modernism. I will read the top of the Wikipedia article first. Modernism is both a philosophical and arts movement that arose from broad transformations in Western society during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. The movement reflected a desire for the creation of new forms of art, philosophy, and social organization, which reflected the newly emerging industrial world, including features such as urbanization, architecture, new technologies, and war. Artists attempted to depart from traditional forms of art, which they considered outdated or obsolete. Modernist innovations included abstract art, stream of consciousness novel, montage cinema, atonal and 12-tone music, divisionist painting, and modern architecture.
Hmm. Okay.
Here's an important bit as it relates to modern art anyway. Modernism explicitly rejected the idea of realism and made use of the works of the past by employment of reprise, incorporation, rewriting, recapitulation, revision, and parody.
Interesting.
Yes. So, like anything, it was a response to the age that came before it. It rejected everything of the age before it and responded to that. So, yes, obviously, as was mentioned, this was heavily influenced by industrialization and late 19th and early 20th century wars.
I wonder why, but okay, so I'm looking at the article too.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm looking at a couple of things. So like in the, maybe this is going to be an adventure. Cause what I'm trying to understand is like, why industrialization? Why war? We've had wars. War never changes.
Except that it did.
It did, though. Yeah, a bit.
World War I changed things.
It did, yeah. But how? Was it the scale that was different?
There was the scale. There was also certainly, like, people finally got a glimpse of the horrors of war, which hadn't really been experienced by... Well, okay, they've been experienced by the populations that were directly affected by war.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think, okay, I think I know what it was. So in wars prior, if two countries, okay, so let's think about a war that happened right before that. The Napoleonic Wars happened not too long before the First World War, right? At scales of human time being what they are. France was at war with everybody for a long time. Okay. And so if the French Empire was encroaching on Germany, and then Russia was going to go do battle with them. Battles were located at places, like just in that place. Like the armies would meet at a field and fight, right? The battlefield. It was a thing. It wasn't like, oh, Farmer John's pasture. It was a big open area. And then whoever won that battle, you know, whoever routed the other, the routed force would retreat to a different place, and then they would meet again for another battle, right? What I think made World War One different is that you had these large swathes of land that just had trenches for miles and miles and miles, and the battle was everywhere. Like, there was not, there were battles at specific locations, but a battle could break out anywhere. It was less of a, there wasn't like the maneuvering that there was before, you know, which had been so indicative of war and battles throughout history, is that, you know, like if you look at Roman warfare, for example, if Rome was going to go battle Carthage, the battle would happen at a specific place. Like the people who were non-combatants weren't like, they could go to the hill and watch the battle, and it was not without risk of being like directly involved in it. Right. Whereas in World War One, these trench lines branched out from cities for miles in either direction, and progress was slow. The war was constant. Battles would go on for months, years even, really. Like, it's hard to know when one battle really ended and one battle really began. It was just constant war and a churn, you know? And I think that that's something that people also saw as somewhat indicative of, like, the Industrial Revolution as well. The work is a churn. Like, it's constant. It's not like, there's not really seasons to it the way there was with occupations before, you know, in the same way. And maybe that's what it was, is just kind of a normalization of those things. And I think that's where monotony came from, because when you read the article, I was like, so wait, people were just bored? Like, because that's what it sounded like when you first read it to me. It's like, well, people got bored with the way things were going. And because new things were happening, they wanted to try new things, which, again, totally fine. You can try new things. That's totally acceptable. But we've done new things before. The Renaissance was a new thing. Well, a renewed thing. You know, but why was this different? It's also interesting that it's weird to me to see philosophy and art together in that way, because they're not, I would not put them together necessarily.
Mm.
Like, what do you think is the rationale of having a philosophical and art movement together? Or is there any, or is it just coincidence?
Well, wherever there is a philosophical movement, art will follow.
Really? You think so?
I mean,
yes. I've not thought about it. That's why I'm asking.
Well, art, as the saying goes, art imitates reality, right? Art mimics reality, mm-hmm. or reflects it, perhaps, is the proper phrasing. Anyway, the point is, yeah, the art that people are creating reflects what is weighing on their mind at a given time. So when either the aftermath of a war, or the rapid changing of life during industrialization, or whatever is happening in your time, if you're an artist, that's going to be one of the first things you think about to make art about. So like, I mean, yeah, you might think of, sure, there are artists that kind of go after sort of perceived universal human experiences and things like that, or very, you know, timeless things. Like, obviously there were going to be artists that are doing, you know, basic stuff like portraits and landscapes and things like that. But there, you know, yeah, there's going to be art that follows any given philosophical movement. I also think of stuff like, you know, getting into the 20th century, protest songs became a big thing, especially in like the 60s. That's what I think of. Yeah, art will follow any widespread philosophical movement or political movement.
Okay. Because another thing that I find interesting too about a lot of this is that, and this is going back to when I was in college. So I had a history professor when I was in college that made special note about this period of time. I don't think he was referring to modernism specifically, but he was talking about what the effects of industrialization were, you know, and how industrialization, like, why you have the Renaissance period, then you have all this time, then you have the Industrial Age, right? Or the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why the times before and after each of those events were different and how they changed. And one of the things he talked about that changed during the Industrial Revolution was that people had more free time than ever after the Industrial Revolution. Like these, and it wasn't so much just the Industrial Revolution. It was the things that took place after the Industrial Revolution kind of got going. You know, before the Industrial Revolution and before we had machines that helped with farming, the vast, vast majority of humans had to make food for us to eat. Like something like 90% of the world or more were farmers. And that's what they did. And farming is an all-day job. Like, it's not the same as industrial labor. You know, there's no boss, really. Like, I know some people have the idea of, like, the plantation-style farming where there is, like, the foreman who's, like, driving serfs or slaves or whatever to do the farming, but
right, but that was a thing out of place at a time.
Yeah,
but that's not farming.
No, the vast majority of farming was you did the things you needed to do on a day-to-day basis when you needed to do them, but if you wanted to just stop for 5 minutes to take a break, there's no manager over your shoulder being like, get back to work. Like, you can do that, right? You're still mostly autonomous. You're not farming because you needed money. You're farming because you know if you don't do that,
you're not going to have enough food.
People are going to starve,
yeah.
You know? And most likely, you're not just farming to make enough food for you. It's not that you're going to starve because there wasn't enough food for you. It's that the people that were going to come take your food away, we're not going to leave enough left behind for you to eat too, you know? And the serfdom way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So you did it to survive. But with the Industrial Revolution, you do have this. Now, all of a sudden, there is oversight. There is the if you think about like the period of effort, people are cramming all of their effort into their workday. And then when they're done, they go home. Like a shift ends and you go home and you've done. You've done the things you needed to do for the day.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't. And in earlier parts of the Industrial Revolution, there were absolutely people who worked like 12, 14-hour days. Like, that was more common. Labor laws came later that kind of reduced that, plus efficiency. You know, people realized that working someone 14 hours a day or 16 hours a day makes less sense than having two people working 8-hour shifts,
mm-hmm.
right? It's more efficient to do it that way. So now you've got all this time where you don't need to work. So what are you doing with it? You know, there was not a market for like leisure activity when everybody farmed.
Right.
It just wasn't. The work
never ends on a farm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to spread out. Farming requires people to be spread fairly evenly across a large right. swathes of land. So now you've got people that are concentrating in centers that have free time and they're being paid wages now, not food. They're being paid wages. So shopping is a thing now. It's not going to market to trade goods for goods. You're getting paid money, which you then spend on goods, which extend beyond your, you know, food and drink. It now there's money left over. You can actually buy things. So now this market's been created. And I think that, and according to him, this is what kind of led to a lot of this, is that you have people sitting around. Like, the middle class was not really a thing before the Industrial Revolution. Like, that's what created the concept of the middle class. The wage worker who has time and disposable income, that's really the first time in human history we've had that at that point. And so I'm wondering how much of this is related to that, is that it's not just the people, because, you know, when you think about, like, the Renaissance didn't, the average peasant farmer was not over there thinking about enlightenment. No, this was a thing led by mostly wealthy people, you know, people that would have read Machiavelli, right? You know, princes and people in the aristocracy are the ones doing the Renaissancing, right? The average serf is still a serf all through the Renaissance and beyond, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that now the average, well, maybe not average, but there's a whole new class of people that don't come directly from the aristocracy that are now thinking about all these things. And it's no wonder that these people wanted to think about things differently, because the way things had been up to that point were not in their favor. They wanted it to be different, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that largely is kind of, I would attribute that with very little evidence to why this movement was different and why art is so closely related to it. Because art is not a thing that people would have. If you were poor, you know, that's an inaccessible, that's not a necessity. Art is not a necessity. It's a luxury, you know? An appreciation of art is something that was reserved mostly for the aristocracy. You know, your average peasant right. farmer did not have a portrait of their family. Or it was a thing that you did once in a generation. You would get your portrait made when you became a man.
Sure.
You know, and that was it.
Or, perhaps more critically, you didn't have a collection of books at home.
Yeah. Yeah, literacy. What is that, you know?
Yeah.
So
postmodernism.
Yeah, the thing that comes topic. After that, yeah.
So I will again read the header paragraphs. So like anything, postmodernism is a reaction to modernism. So postmodernism is an intellectual stance or mode of discourse characterized by skepticism toward the grand narratives of modernism, rejection of epistemic certainty or the stability of meaning, and sensitivity to the role of ideology in maintaining political power. Claims to objectivity are dismissed as naive realism, with attention drawn to the conditional nature of knowledge claims within particular historical, political, and cultural discourses. The postmodern outlook is characterized by self-referentiality, epistemological relativism, moral relativism, pluralism, irony, irreverence, and eclecticism. It rejects the universal validity of binary oppositions, stable identity, hierarchy, and categorization. Initially emerging from a mode of literary criticism, postmodernism developed in the mid-20th century as a rejection of modernism and has been observed across many disciplines. Postmodernism is associated with the disciplines deconstruction and post-structuralism. Various authors have criticized postmodernism as promoting obscurantism, as abandoning Enlightenment rationalism and scientific rigor, and as adding nothing to analytical or empirical knowledge.
Harsh.
But true.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. All right. So there's a lot to break down here. So first, it's an intellectual stance or mode of discourse. So a way of discussing things.
Sure.
We'll say. Arguably a philosophy.
Right. I would think. Obviously. Arguably a philosophical movement.
Sure.
And perhaps even an artistic movement.
Especially in the literary arts. But
yes, especially literary.
So let's walk down the list of things. So it's characterized by skepticism, which is in line with the tradition of modernism.
Skepticism toward the grand narratives of modernism. That's the specific thing.
Sure.
Not skepticism per se, but skepticism toward modernism.
Right. But you can't. Okay. I would say that they inherited the ability of skeptic, the maybe not ability, but the sense of skepticism, and then they just narrowed its focus. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
maybe.
I mean, we'll see how it jives with the rest of it. So, grand narratives. So, what are these grand narratives, I guess? This is the thing that I'm curious about. Oh, meta-narrative.
So, I'm going to, before we read that, I'm going to say that when I think of grand narratives of modernism, I'm thinking about like how people kind of, people in the modern era tried to like capture the human experience with stories and use that as the fuel for political movements. I'm thinking about like the kind of stuff that gave rise to fascism and communism. These stories, these narratives about how the power got to where it is and where it ought to be and how we can change that.
I think it goes deeper than that, though. Mm. I mean, I agree, yes, but I think that, like, okay, let's do this the literary way. I think there's a perfect allegory here of the modernist versus the postmodernist outlook when it comes to the literary sense of narrative. Because most narratives are of a meta-narrative family, right? So, especially in in literature. So let's take Disney remakes and talk about them through these lenses. Fair?
Okay.
The Jungle Book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you've seen the original Jungle Book.
Yes.
What's the story? What's the meta narrative subtext of the story of the Jungle Book that you can remember? Like, if you had to give a like highlighted one paragraph synopsis of the Jungle Book, what would it be?
Like a synopsis of the plot, or like
the plot? Yeah.
The
plot is narrative. Yeah.
Boy gets lost in the jungle.
Okay.
It is befriended by certain animals who try to guide him back to his people.
Right.
Or at least back to some people that they assume are his people.
Right. And more importantly, I think, okay, so let's dig a little bit deeper. Boy raised by wolves.
Right.
Okay. Is rejected from wolves because he's not a wolf.
Yes.
Is then guided by, what, I think a jaguar and a bear?
Like a panther and a bear,
yeah. A panther and a bear. Through all the other tribes of not people,
right,
who are personified, to his people where he belongs.
Yes.
That's the narrative context. Is it's a story of you can get along with others, but you are of a kind. You belong to a category and you belong with your category.
Right.
That's the meta narrative of the Jungle Book. And there's no shame in feeling like you're not a part of a group when you're not, right? That's doesn't jive well. And so the criticism, I feel like the postmodern criticism of the Jungle Book would be people can belong to whatever category they want. People do not have to belong to their category, because one of the things that is also rejected is the stable identity, the hierarchy, and the categorization. Well, you have to have a stable identity to belong to a category of people, right? In this case, of the category being people.
Right, you know? That is a category, yes.
Yes, so the rejection would be that, well, in the Jungle Book, what's his name?
The boy?
Yeah.
Mowgli.
Mowgli, yeah. Mowgli should be able to be affirmed as a wolf. So I guess postmodern retelling would be Mowgli becomes a furry. but do you see what I mean? Like that's a rejection. So I would not be surprised that a remaking of that in a postmodernist lens would be boy raised by wolves stays wolf. Yeah, boy raised by wolves, the end. Yeah. There's no need to move. Right. And most meta narratives have to do with undoing some calamity in the order of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
The hierarchy being a symbol of order.
It is a type of order, yes.
Yes. Well, and it also presupposes that there is an order.
Mm-hmm.
An order
that should be adhered to, yes.
Right.
I think that's the critical thing, is that, yeah.
Yeah, should be adhered to, or B is.
Right.
Like, almost tautologically is. And this is where I think the criticism can be valid, but it depends on what you're talking about. Because then there is
right.
such...
I can get behind that when we're talking about, like, the order of the king, right?
Okay, hold on. Next Disney, The Lion King.
Okay.
What's the meta narrative of The Lion King? Okay, Simba.
Yeah.
Simba, heir to throne.
Simba, the prince. Yes.
Prince, heir of throne.
He can't wait to be king.
He cannot wait to be king. Uncle deposes and kills father.
Yes.
Becomes king.
Murders the king and seizes the throne. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so the prince goes off to be not king. He's actually happy. He goes and lives with. There's always like two animal companions. I feel like there's a trend here.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing.
So Timon and Pumbaa, the meerkat and
Warthog,
raise him as... And they don't try to make him into a warthog or meerkat. He's just not king.
They're just bros, yeah.
They're bros, yeah. He's just one of the guys. But then the girl, Nala, comes in, princess...
And ruins everything, as they do.
As they do. Princess comes in and says, no. Well, actually, I think Rafiki comes in first. Doesn't matter. Symbols... within the old guard of order,
mm-hmm.
who are now in the new regime. Granted, they oppose the new regime because it's out of order, because one of the things that this guy does is kick essentially up in the order by moving the scavengers up, the hyenas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and there's, I think, a veil critique in there, but we'll leave that be. Says, no, you are the rightful king. And the reason things are all messed up is because you're not king. If you were just king, things would be okay, because that's how it should be. So, unthrone your right. uncle.
Yeah, for some reason, we have to bring Simba back as king instead of just killing Scar and getting our society back together the way we want it to be.
Exactly.
It has to be Simba as king.
The chosen one idea. And yes. The family lineage, right? Star Wars has the same one, by the way. There's a reason every important character in Star Wars up until very recently was a Skywalker, because they're the chosen family. Mm-hmm. Like, they're a dynasty. Same thing in The Lion King. The concept of the dynasty is a old world order idea. And so he goes and deposes, and boom, there you go. Things are all made right again because the right person's sitting on the throne. Criticism of that is exactly what you said. Why can't literally anyone else just dethrone Scar and become...
Why do we need a king in the first place?
Yeah, yeah. All these things. Why can't Simba be a bum? You know,
like... Well, and of course, this is all... You know, there's also the story... You know, the moral thrown right in your face right at the beginning of the movie about the circle of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have our place.
Yes.
The lion eat the antelope, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Down the chain.
Down the chain, yep. Yeah, exactly. And if anything, you would
It's right that we kill them because it's our place to kill them. And eventually we'll die too, so that makes it okay somehow.
That'll make it okay somehow. And the scavengers belong at the bottom because they're worse. And that's, like, Scar's biggest sin. It's not that he killed his brother or his brother-in-law. I don't know how that works in the family tree. But it's that he also promotes the scavengers above the social order. Like, these people that belong lower in the food chain, he brings up in the food chain as his foot soldiers, right? And so that's, like, the biggest offense. And they're evil. Like, they are just, like, flat evil in the movie because of that. So...
I mean, they literally use Nazi imagery to depict them, so yeah.
Yeah. So to a certain extent, I get it. Those are valid critiques. Where I begin to draw the line is where they start questioning objectivity. Like the sentence that says claims to objectivity are dismissed as naive realism.
Yes.
Excuse me. No. No. Like a good example is... I'm going to quote another literary-ish reference. This is a show. We've been talking about movies, but narratives are all literary anyway.
Sure.
There's a show called Chernobyl that I watched. It was an HBO miniseries, which is really good, by the way.
I wonder what that's about.
Yeah, well, spoiler alert, Chernobyl.
It's about Chernobyl.
So the lead scientist who is going through and helping solve Chernobyl ends up testifying at the trial of the three people that the state decided to hold responsible, and just spills the beans that this was actually totally preventable, but the Communist Party hid the flaws because there could be no doubt in their nuclear program. So in his words, lies are what caused Chernobyl, not incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
The incompetence was bad, but the lies are what made it as bad as it was.
It would never have gotten that far if we were allowed to tell the truth, yeah.
Exactly. And so he gets essentially hauled in the back, and this is where it gets really literary. He gets hauled in the back by the head of the KGB, who, you know, is trying to talk him about it. And the point he makes is that why are you so obsessed with why? Why does it matter how fast the bullet is going when it penetrates your skull? You're dead anyway. And that's, I think, kind of trying to make the point that you can complain and not like something that's objectively true, but to call it anything other than the truth is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are like the two forces at play, is the truth of the reality of the situation plus the truth of the deeds of those who are hiding within the truth.
So to try to steel man a little bit, I think you might be misinterpreting that phrasing.
Sure.
That claims to objectivity are dismissed as naive realism. I think what this means, I think it becomes more clear if you take the next part of the sentence. Claims to objectivity are dismissed as naive realism, with attention drawn to the conditional nature of knowledge claims within, etc. So I think the idea here is, like, claiming that your perspective is objective and is not colored by your biases and such.
Mm.
That is naive realism. Believing that you see reality the way that it is.
I see. I guess, again, it depends. I don't inherently have an issue, though, with calling the subjective interpretation into question when it's merited. Mm-hmm. The issue I have is that it seems to always be called into question, even when it isn't. You know, like, there are things that can be proven that it, and I guess it also depends, right? And I think this is something we've seen a lot in our, because we are living in the postmodern age, I suppose. You know, let's take an example. So there, I think there's also often a conflation between statistics and facts here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where this criticism is the most poignant. So for example, for a long time, crime statistics were used as the basis for policymaking,
mm-hmm.
right? A valid claim is that if the statistics are flawed, as will be the policies that are used to address the statistic.
Mm-hmm.
That's a valid claim. You know, just because right. crime, for example,
Garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. Just because crime tends to be more prevalent in certain areas does not necessarily mean that the people in those areas commit, they may commit more crimes, but the reason, but it may not
but
be.
But is it because of the people or is it because of the situation there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's a valid criticism in more data required, you know. But to criticize other things like, how do I want to address this next subject? How far are we into the episode? We're well beyond 30 minutes. The censors won't be listening anymore. We talked about The Lion King. They logged off after that. For example, to call into question the efficacy of certain required medications, we'll say, or vaccines. Yeah, that's an interesting one because that's less about the statistics, but could be. And also, games being played with statistics, I feel like can go both ways,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't know, man, like, I often, I'm just going to get real with you here on this one. I often feel like when I make a claim based on either statistics or some facts, when I'm told that those are wrong and they're being colored by my issues, I'm often given anecdotal evidence as a response.
Right.
And what
which is hardly evidence. Yeah,
exactly. And that's my biggest issue.
Anecdotal evidence is evidence, but it isn't much.
But I feel like the tendency of those who hold a postmodernist view is to hold anecdotal evidence to the same level because mine is just as objective as theirs.
Yes. And this, I think a value that wasn't mentioned here, although it is like kind of related to a lot of these, but they didn't call it out specifically, but like the placement of value on lived experience.
Get out. I don't care. I'm sorry. I don't like, you can't make policies that affect all people based on an individual's lived experience, in my opinion.
Right.
No, not even in my opinion. I'm going to assert that that's bad objectively, but I know it's still an opinion, but like,
well, I think you could easily make the case that yeah, it's going to lead to mistakes because your lived experience is so narrow
mm-hmm.
compared to the lived experience of everyone in the society that it is foolhardy at best
mm-hmm.
to use that as a basis for creating policy for the society at large.
Absolutely. I'm going to assert something else too, now that I think about it.
Okay.
I think one of the other things that tarnishes postmodernism for me, since it has its roots and is closely related to, I think the closeness of literary analysis as its root, right? There's this tendency, I feel like, to assert that if you can change the narrative, right? Because the purpose mm-hmm. of literary analysis is to do two things. One, to explain a narrative, but for what reason?
To critique the narrative.
And beyond that, what else? To write a better one.
Right, to replace the narrative.
Exactly. Yeah. It's self-defeating, in my opinion, to take this and then go, okay, we're going to apply a literary context here, and it works in the concept of literature, and we're carrying over the skepticism, the tendency to also want to carry over the idea of if we can just rewrite the narrative of reality. And to a degree, that is possible for things yet to come. You can change how things will be to an extent, but what you cannot do is change the way they are now, right now, and prior. And I feel like there's this strong tendency to go, well, if we're in the story of reality, in the narrative, all we have to do is make the main characters this, change the circumstances to this, and it's as easy as stroking the pen. And then, as long as it's almost like the same thing as before, where it's like, if we just put the right person in, the right narrative person to fit, if we change the hero to be like this, then the outcome of the story will be the way we want it to be, based on the narrative critique. But there is no single author to the narrative of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even really written by committee, because it's not one narrative. You know what I mean? Like, and if you could do that, I mean, people could be however they wanted to be. They actually could be.
Right.
Addiction wouldn't be a thing. Just change your character sheet to say not an addict.
Yeah.
But you're still going to crave the thing that you were addicted to.
Right. It doesn't matter how loudly you say, I'm not addicted.
Yeah.
If you still come crying for more, you are.
Yeah. And it doesn't help you if the people trying to actually help you not be addicted just tell you that you're not addicted and affirm right, that's that not going to help addicted.
You either. Yeah.
Yeah. And we are all also kind of the result of the net forces upon us. And we don't necessarily exert the same influence over the forces that influence us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an incredibly poignant point, I think, to make in the modern era, where it seems like people have more influence than ever.
But they don't.
But they don't. Yeah.
Right.
Because, like, let's think
you
about...
You can be heard by more people than ever, perhaps.
But the sea of people that people are hearing is bigger than ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that's one of the issues, you know, with dealing with that is that... Because I think that a lot of the people that advocate for changes in the scope of postmodernism believe in activism. Like, most, I feel like, activists would believe that they're postmodernists these days. And they think that all they would need to do is get out there and change enough minds. Well, you can't sometimes change minds. You also can't reach everybody. And I think that the disproportionate feeling of, you know, let's just mix this with what I'm trying to get at. The internet. I can measure how many people have seen what I've written.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning, you know, if I wrote a book 200 years ago, and someone came and told me, yes, I have sold 500 copies of your book, I can be sure that at least 500 people have read it, and those are one of the only books they've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if 5 million people see my tweet, but what does that mean? Did they actually read it? How many tweets are they reading a day?
Did they actually even engage with it, even if they read the words, right?
Mm-hmm. And if they did engage with it, so what? They double tapped it and gave it a like and then scrolled on. The amount of space I occupied in their view and consideration, mental consideration, is being squeezed out by everybody else mm-hmm. who also has this power now. You know, it's no different than it was before. It just feels different to the writer because we have the feedback of the company that moved our communications and even some direct feedback from the people who read it. But, and some do have this, right? Like and I think this is one of the reasons why I do like YouTube better. You can actually see how people are engaging with something that was created there, and it's much more long form, but the longer form something is, the less it's competing because there is less time available for other things when it's a long form like that.
Yeah.
You know? So I think I got off the, we got off of, on a tangent for a bit.
Yes.
So
I think the next thing on here that gets under my skin, and I think a lot of people, well, skeptics especially, epistemological relativism. You know what that means offhand?
Well, I know what epistemological means based on epistemology.
Yes, it does mean that.
I know what relativism means, mm-hmm. sort of. I'm more familiar with moral relativism as a practitioner of moral relativism. Let me tell
you. Yes.
But go ahead.
I will restate epistemological relativism in two different words, much shorter words. My truth.
Yeah.
That is what that is. This is a bizarre thing to me, but I've tried often to try to figure out why people think this way, that the truth is actually subjective. I'm going to make a far back reference. One of the first people we ever talked about on this show, Anthony Magnabosco.
Oh, yes.
The front man of street epistemology.
Mm-hmm.
Not the inventor, but he's the foremost guy, I think, still. A common thing that he would use to try to pin down people's understanding of the truth is he would hold a like a bottle of Tic Tacs. He would just carry that with him. And he would propose the question, okay, are there an even or odd number of Tic Tacs in the bottle?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they may or may not give an answer. And he would say, okay, well, if you say that there's an even number and I say there's an odd number, then one of us has to be wrong, right? Because there can only be an even or an odd number. And you'd be surprised the number of people who would say no, that you could both be right. It was a disturbing number. The closest that I can get to trying to figure out where people are coming from here is like just this deep fear of confrontation.
I was going to say that, or the deep fear of being wrong as well.
True. That's the other side is, if I just pretend that we can both be right, then you can't call me wrong either. I don't have to take that risk.
Yeah. Can we compromise on both being right and then not look into it?
Yeah.
And leave it in this quasi-quantum state where we're both potentially right. Yeah.
And this kind of feeds into the rejection of, like, enlightenment thinking and scientific rigor. You know, I don't care that you can prove logically or empirically so-and-so a proposition is true. That goes against my narrative. It goes against my... It's not true to me, right? That's a deeply unsettling thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't really know what to do about it besides... Well...
Make fun.
Well, yeah, you can make fun of people, but then you're just going to be called rude.
But then again, you could also be called rude for saying that someone's wrong.
I think that's kind of dumb as well, but...
But that's also what they're doing.
But it is true. There are rude and less rude ways to call people out on being mistaken.
Sure.
I think that's a careful thing to do. Yeah, it's a dangerous idea for the same... I mean, this is, again, one of the first episodes we did about why the truth matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you and I both value the...
Well, the truth.
Yes.
Not a truth.
Not a truth. The truth matters. Because it doesn't matter what you think. If you're wrong, eventually something bad is going to happen to you.
Right.
Because... And this could be as mundane as... The thing you're trying to do doesn't work out, and that's a bummer. Or as important as you're dead because you didn't think that the bus was really going to hit you.
Wasn't my truth.
I'm invincible in my truth, right?
you know, yeah. Huh. That is interesting. I think, too, this ties back to their... Okay, so we also did another episode. We did an episode on narratives a while back.
We did an episode on stories.
Stories, yeah. That's what I mean. Where I discuss narratives.
Yes.
And one of the interesting things, I think, that is related to this is... One of the things that makes a story interesting to engage with is ambiguity. Like, there are certain things, like, a good story has a healthy balance of ambiguity and asserted truth. Good example. Very few people appreciate Dune. But there are also very few debates had about Dune in its story because it's all written. Frank Herbert wrote everything. Like, he was very explicit in what exactly happened and went into the back.
I've looked at a hard copy of Dune before and decided that was too much for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of a book in a series. So, but it's a very well-established, well-fleshed-out fictional verse. And by that, I mean he sat there and thought it all out, wrote it all out, and said, this is how it is. No problems. What makes Dune hard to engage with some people, for some people, is that some people, when they read, enjoy making up their own kind of thoughts about it. Harry Potter does this. What makes it so good to a lot of people, I feel like, is that they leave enough unsaid that you can fill in the blanks with whatever you want to be true, and it's totally valid because it's all made up anyway. Applying this to reality is dangerous.
Yes.
Because... It is all there. Someone knows the truth, was there when it happened. Things are the way they are. You can't necessarily go back and
I don't know that I necessarily agree that somebody knows the truth.
Okay, I mean, like, of an instance. Like, if you were to ask a question like, oh, what if Abraham Lincoln actually, like, loved horse racing? Well, someone knows whether he did or not.
Mm-hmm. Or knew.
Or knew, and then passed it down, wrote it down, whatever. And little things like that they don't really matter, right?
Sure, that's inconsequential. Never going to change your life.
But if I went back and said that there was no Confederate States of America and slavery never happened, that actually does have some pretty big implications.
That has huge implications, yes.
Yeah, if you write that out of the story because it's ugly and you don't like it. Or you can paint all of the people who participated in any ugly, bad thing in history as all pure evil spawns of Satan, and that's how it was. When that also isn't true.
That also is not true, and you're going to make mistakes by ignoring their actual motivations for doing what they did.
Right. And you probably wouldn't.
Because the way that people like that can get into power is by people believing that you have to be pure evil to do something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, I've never met a pure evil person in my life.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about it. Like, your truth is not truth. It's just your experience.
Yeah.
It, that simple. And also, I think the other core thing about this is that if it's your truth and you're the only one who can determine your truth, then any opinion you have that is, if the reason you believe something, it gets down, I think, to the core issue of why people believe things, which again goes back to kind of our first episode. If you can just believe whatever you want, then you're going to fall out of correlation with reality and also with your fellow persons, mm-hmm. people. We do not know your truth. We did not live your experience. And you can tell us, and this is a thing that people, I feel like, that are postmodernists love to do. They love to sit down and proselytize about their truth as though it should matter to me.
Right, but why?
But why? Yeah. Like, and don't get me wrong.
If you want to just tell me about your life experience, that might be valuable to me in some way.
Sure. And it might help me understand you as a person and why you do the things that you do.
Well, even telling me about your made up truth tells me about you as a person, but
not in a good way.
No. It teaches me that you're someone I don't want to associate with because you are admittedly detached from reality.
Right. And it bears all the same problems with those who are like super religious. It's mm-hmm. the same thing.
Yes. That's where I was going. So, the person who raised this topic to me and asked me to do this on the show is somebody who is kind of a a casual, like, polytheist. And I have had a few conversations with this person about that, and I don't think they seriously believe that there are gods. But basically the argument always comes down to, well, I think it's fun to believe that these things are real. Mm. It makes life more interesting to think about it that way. And what's the harm in believing it?
Oh dear.
Yeah.
I'm gonna tell a story. I know someone different than this that they actually have a problem. Like they actually had a problem, I should say, where this person is incredibly creative and is really good at making things, right? And they love their dreams. They love the world of their dreams because in their dreams, anything can happen, but they're safe.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, you're in a dream. And they can bring those dreams to reality in their artwork and in their poetry and in all the things that they do. And they have a tendency to want to be in that place.
Okay.
And there's nothing wrong with wanting to think outside of the confines of normal reality and rational thinking.
Sure, that's what fantasy is.
Sure. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that to a point. But to try to make fantasy real is where you start to, I think, cross the boundaries into pure delusion. And this person knows that, but they struggle with it. And this person's had a lot, their truth and their experience, I should say, in life has not been great. And so it's easy. And escapism is a big part of that. And there's a point, you know, everything in moderation, as they say. I don't think there's anything wrong with a little bit of indulgence in fantasy and thinking. But to believe it, and to also suggest that you can just believe it, I call that into question too. Can you?
Well, yeah, we've talked about this before. Can you even choose your own beliefs?
Right.
No.
No, you can't.
You're not in control of what convinces you that something is true.
But I do think that you can, just like you can reinforce a skill, just like you can reinforce a habit, you can make a habit out of delusion.
Well, and you can say, oh, wow, this idea is very aesthetically pleasing to me, and then start musing to yourself about, okay, what if it's true? And then you might see something and be like, oh, well, that kind of actually lines up with this thing that I've been musing might be true. Maybe it really is true. And you can kind of convince yourself of something that way.
Well, but more importantly is anything that doesn't align gets reshuffled to be something
true. Else. That's true. Anything that would fly in your face and say, and make it obvious to you that no, it's not true, is just briefly upsetting as you write it off. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's dangerous.
Yes.
You know, there's the practical example of how that's dangerous. You know, like, for example, if you were to see a fire start in your kitchen and be like, oh, that's not really there. That's just an illusion, you know. And it honestly reminds
me... Boy, that sure would suck if my house burned down. Yeah.
Well, and it honestly reminds me a lot of... And there are times when this... Like, North Korea is a mass delusion. Like, for example, there are people that live in that country who actually look at the state of things and think that this is the best place on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they know, they hear about other places, they've maybe even seen pictures. The diplomats that leave North Korea and travel the world have to be some of the most delusional people on the planet to go back and be like, yes, dear leader, this is a wonderful place. This is the best. And it's amazing to see how hard the human psyche works to keep everything in alignment. You know, like back when we talked about, I think we brought up split brains before, how, you know, people that have had, I forgot what the name of the operation is, but they have their
corpus callosum.
Yeah, they have their corpus callosum cut, and the two parts of their brain, the two hemispheres of their brain cannot communicate with one another. How hard part of your brain is geared to just accept things that are just blatantly false and build a narrative around it and accept it as truth, because that is so important to you. And it is very important to human beings to have a consistent narrative for their consciousness to be able to accept everything. And to knowingly, to know that and to train that to not be the case. I mean, this is what people do when they've suffered traumas, you know. And what's troubling is that I feel like this can lead someone to exhibit the same behaviors as someone who actually has experienced a trauma when they haven't, as almost like a nocebo. And that's terrifying. And I think that that's something that we've absolutely seen, you know. You and I both have seen like plenty of examples of people who, you know, they caught on camera acting certain ways, and you look at it and go, man, this person's ridiculous. There's no way they actually believe that's true, but they could. You can delude yourself to that point, and that's super concerning and exploiting a weakness in the human psyche that I really don't think we should be trying to exploit. You know, it would explain a lot of things, and it does almost lend itself to that first person's perspective that it is true that you can choose what you believe. It is true that your truth is relative, not because it actually is, but because you can modify your perception, which is all that you need to do to justify that truth to yourself. But then you will constantly be confused as to why everything else is not the way you think it is. And it's so much easier to externalize that problem as other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's their fault that this is not true. It's their fault. They're trying to, like, how many people, like, have you ever met somebody who did not know what the word gaslight meant, and then they learned what that word meant, and then they start using it a lot? Have you ever had that experience?
Yes. Well, maybe not with gaslight specifically, but I've definitely had lots of experiences where somebody learns a word and they use it all the time.
Well, I didn't watch this video.
They especially like to use it incorrectly because they barely know what it means.
Sure. Okay, so I know people that, like, have learned the word gaslight and become all of a sudden aware that, wait a minute, people lie to people to get them to do things.
That's gaslighting.
And then all of a sudden, every time something doesn't align with what they think is true,
someone's gaslighting them.
Exactly. Oh, they're just trying to gaslight me into believing what they want so they can manipulate me. And it's like, this person's starting to behave a lot more like a paranoid schizophrenic now, even though they have never been diagnosed with that and they don't have that. They sure are behaving like it, you know, and that's dangerous, you know. And I think against the spirit of, like, what makes humans helpfully social. Like, it's taking one of the biggest tools that allowed us to not be like the other animals and actually making it something that drives us apart, which is particularly concerning as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I'm reading through this again to make sure we didn't miss much, but
there's a few more things. We're kind of running up on time
a little bit. There is one I want to quickly talk about.
Okay.
Deconstruction. There's only one area in which I've actually seen I've seen this word, like, used, and it's culinary, and I hate it. Have you ever heard of someone said you want a deconstructed hamburger? Where they hand you, like, a loaf of bread and, like, a pound of cooked hamburger meat and, like, the pickles. It's all just disassembled. And really? We're going to use our philosophy to not give me a hamburger? But it literally is that level of delusion. They still call it that. It's a deconstructed hamburger. No, it's not a hamburger at all. It's literally not. It's just the ingredients for a hamburger.
It's ingredients you could use to make a hamburger from nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, but my truth might say that the hamburger meat goes on the outside of the bun, so I need to be able to construct it my way. That's why I want a deconstructed hamburger. And then I can still call it a hamburger.
You need to wash your hands.
But I think, as an aside real quick, I think one other thing. I can't help but think the internet's somewhat responsible for this as well, a bit. I think there's a lot to the idea that I think you had brought up about how when people all of a sudden realize they can make their avatar on the internet whatever they wanted and people will treat them that way, that is absolutely a way for you to, I think, fall into the trap of this and kind of has some of the hallmarks of it. It's like, oh, my name is not this. My name is whatever my username is. Oh, I'm not, you know, a 30-something male living with my parents. I'm actually a unicorn, and you have to treat me as such. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and on the internet, when it's all fun and games, sure, whatever, man. Yeah, do whatever you want. We're on the internet having fun. But when fun becomes life, you know, it's unhealthy. And I think you even see that, too, with people in non-internet things. Like, look at some of these people who play sports professionally, which is hilarious to me. Like, and that's an American thing, too. Mm-hmm. Like, there are people who play professional sports in other countries. But when you look at the vast majority of sports in other countries, it's average everyday people that also play the sport as a hobby. Like, there's this thing called the World Baseball Classic that essentially is like the Olympics for baseball, where countries, you know, there's a USA team, whatever. So the USA team is all pro players that play in the MLB, except for those who come from other countries who then go home to play in their home countries. But then there's like a Czechoslovakian team where their manager is a neurosurgeon, their catcher is an accountant, and like that's what they are, you know. And it's just weird to think that there's one person here that they spend their entire life being an athlete, and they're paid money to do this, and that's their identity. Lots of money. It's their identity to be an athlete, you know.
Right, it's not just a thing that they do.
It's who they are.
Yeah.
Everything. Like, oh, I accidentally broke a finger. These people will break down and cry over that because that's the end of their career. Or, like, potentially, you know. Whereas if I broke my finger, I'd be like, oh, well, that's really inconvenient. A few months later.
That's going to hurt for a while and be, yeah.
Yeah. It is strange. So where did you want to go with this since we are running up on time?
I think, well, before we escape from that, from deconstruction, I think I just wanted a comment about that. So deconstruction, you know, separating, you know, it's like the, it seems to be like the very opposite of how conservatives, think about how like words have very rigid meanings. Mm. Like, especially religious folks think, well, and by religious, I mean Christians specifically. Those are the ones that I have experience with anyway, who think like words are magical and you need to use them the right way.
Yes.
And it's like sinful to use a word to mean something else. And so that, you know, and so we've taken the healthy approach of saying, well, no, actually words are not magical and we can define words to mean things that are useful in our conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can use whatever word I want so long as we agree what it means. But then this has been further deconstructed into words mean what I think they mean. Yeah. And, you know, if something feels like so-and-so a word to me, then it is that to me. It feeds back into the subjective reality thing.
I mean, look no further than like the debate about pronouns, right?
Right.
You know, the old school conservative view is nope, man mean, he and she, he and him mean this, she and her mean that. Period. End of story, right? Other people will say, well, no, we should be able to use they for anyone, and then these two things can be used however. And the struggle is the acceptance part, like you had said, is, well, in order for those things to be able to actually mean either thing, we all need to agree. So, and that's the issue I think that people have problem with is, of course, the conservatives who by default disagree and think that they have rigid meanings are just not going to agree.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you, I think this is, and maybe this is where we tee off, because this is, we do need to talk about the politics and power dynamics, because that's a huge part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where that conversation comes up, where it's how do you make your truth actually truth, acceptable by others?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you need the politics and power to make other people accept your truth. So I think that's where we leave it off. And then we come back and talk about that next week, because okay. I think we could go on for a while about that too. All right. So until next time, philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.